Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us today. Before we jump into our conversation about schools in Chicago, then Baltimore and Chicago. By the way, next week we'll bring Philadelphia into this conversation. Look, as we continue our conversation with people around the nation about school systems, as well as our own here in the city of Baltimore. I want to remind you what's happening today in history. Many, many moons ago, in 1431, Joan of Arc was martyred. This was also, we think, the birthday of the great poet County Cullen, who was born here in Baltimore in 1903, very famously married Nina Du Bois, the daughter of W.E.B. Du Bois. He was an incredible poet, activist. He was a person who, if you haven't read his poetry, you should. I should have a poem ready for you, but I don't. I apologize for that. He used a lot of Christian imagery in his work, and he was, when I remember the one thing I read about him, there's a poem he wrote called The Black Christ, and the poem was when he compared the lynching of a black man to the crucifixion of Jesus. And he also questioned our beliefs in God at the same time. An amazing human being, an incredible writer. And today was the day that he was born, and we will have some of his poems up on our website at steinershow.org after this program. This is also in the middle of waging the war in the Spanish Civil War. It's interesting, this is the day that the Germans entered the war, much like people are talking about in Syria now, becoming an internationalized conflict, which we'll talk about later in this program. That's what began happening today in the Spanish Civil War, which was right fighting the left, democracy fighting fascism, going on in Spain in the 1930s. Those are the three elements we'll talk about from today's history. And right now, we are going to jump into our conversation. Chicago schools have been all over the news in the country. They closed 50 schools. They said to save money. This is clearly a nationwide trend. Philadelphia is not saying they're going to close 23 schools. Chicago is saying that they had a $1 billion projected deficit. They had to do this. Baltimore City is closing schools. And so we begin this conversation with our folks in Chicago. Joining us once again is Stacey Davis Gates, who is legislative director of the Chicago Teachers Union. We're also joined by Diane Schossenbach, who is faculty fellow at the Institute for Policy Research, associate professor in human development and social policy at Northwestern University. Rashawn Biddle, editor and publisher of Dropout Nation, columnist for the American Spectator, and Elaine Weiss, national coordinator of Broader, Bolder Approach to Education campaign at the Economic Policy Institute. And folks, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good morning. Nice to be here. Thank you.
So let's begin. I think this is clearly going on around the country. Let me start, Diane, if you can give us your sense of the overview of what's happening in Chicago and why. I mean, the school system clearly says that this is the only way to save Chicago schools, only way to save money in Chicago schools is to close schools that have where population is down and where the performance of students is down.
That's right. Over the last decade or so, Chicago Public Schools has lost, I think, about 100,000 students, right? So as a result, we've got overcapacity in some areas and actually crowding in other areas, right? Of course, anytime we're dealing with schools and children in neighborhoods, we have a spatial problem, right? Sometimes too many kids live in one neighborhood and not enough live in another neighborhood. On top of that, the district was facing this very, very large budget deficit, and I guess when pushed, you know, when they were trying to figure out how do we close this large budget deficit, you know, they looked around and they couldn't find, I think, a better way to close that deficit other than reducing their overall size of their footprint, trying to save some money by consolidating schools across areas. You know, it sounds like you all have been following this out there in Baltimore. This is a very traumatic conversation that the city has been having. You know, I think there's a lot of debate whether 50 was the right number or not, but at the end of the day, this is what the board decided, was that we need to save this money and this is how we're going to do it.
And Stacey Davis-Gates, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you with us again.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about the union perspective, the teacher's perspective on all of this. I'm very curious as to the opposition. Some people say it's a union kind of self-serving. I'd like to explain that from your perspective.
I mean, I think people's image of the union is dated. In fact, the CTU under the leadership of Karen Lewis has made it very clear that this union is one that is deeply tied to the needs of the community and the parents and the families that rely upon public education. we're clear that public education is a public good and that needs to be preserved in Chicago and nationally, and to ensure that, you know, every student in Chicago has an opportunity to get a high-level education. We know that Chicago has only lost 30,000 students, and we know that this underutilization crisis has been manufactured by the loss of affordable housing in Chicago, by the proliferation of charter schools in the same areas where the district claims depopulation. So to say that this plan, as it went through, we're less than happy about it, is certainly an understatement. We feel that the district is doing too much at one time. It does not have the capacity, nor does it have the track record to ensure safety for the families that have to, you know, travel these distances to the new schools. We know that the transportation, the main transportation line on the south side, which is the red line, has been shut down for the next 5 months at least, and that this is going to provide a tremendous amount of stress on families in terms of how they will transition into their new school communities. It's a mess in Chicago. I don't think that we can speak about this in isolation. We have a loss of affordable housing. We have an uptick in violent crime, homicides. Just last night, 4 people were murdered, 11 were wounded, and shootings. These are the same communities where the schools are being taken out. These are the same communities where there's a lack of affordable housing. We have a senator who says his plan for going after gangs is not job creation, is not making sure that schools are properly resourced and funded, but in incarcerating them. I mean, our priorities are completely out of whack in Chicago, and it's becoming clearer and clearer that a certain demographic of people in Chicago are no longer wanted there.
And Rashawn, please jump into this, because I know that you have a different perspective on this whole question of loss of students and what the shutdown means and the question of charter schools.
Well, first thing, let's start off with this fact. You know, charter schools don't even make up 15% of the enrollment in all Chicago students. So basically, you know, for all the talk about charter schools are supposedly taking away a lot of students, the reality is that's not necessarily so. The reality is, if you look at the numbers, you know, between 1991-92 and 2010-2011, the percentage of black students in Chicago declined by 26%. In fact, black students aren't even the majority in the district. And so at the end of the day, yes, a lot of black students are getting affected by the school closings, but that's also because they're also in the neighborhoods which have lost population. They've lost people. And the reason is a simple one. Yes, so I'll say this right here. Chicago under Daley, under Richard Daley, under Rahm Emanuel, there has been improvement in student achievement. But it's not nearly good enough, especially for middle-class black families who can afford to move into the suburbs, and definitely not for white families who have long been frustrated by what has been happening in Chicago. And so from their perspective, it's just time, you know, they're moving. They're walking with their feet. And, you know, from my perspective, listen, I'm not a big fan of closing schools. But on the other hand, I'm also not a big fan of keeping schools open that are not fit for kids. If the choice comes down to keeping a district or even a school or even a district open that doesn't actually serve kids well versus closing down schools and moving to a different model of education where we can actually provide families with a wide array of opportunities that their children need and deserve, then you close the schools. That's what you move to a different model.
So, and Elaine, let me let you jump in with your thoughts on this, and then we're going to have some serious questions. Well, they're all serious questions, other questions about how this affects Chicago and the nation.
Well, this is, to me, kind of a curious set of assertions that closing schools is the right way to do this. There is no history anywhere in any city that suggests that closing schools does any of the things that, for example, Mr. Biddle just suggested they would do. Chicago has been closing schools, granted a much smaller number, so we can look at sort of a less traumatic, less disruptive, but same model over the past 10 years. virtually none of those kids went to a better school. So the contention that by closing these schools, we'll send kids to a better school, it's been done in this city by essentially these same leaders in the same way, and it hasn't done that. And I'm hard-pressed to understand how, if we couldn't find receiving schools that were so great to receive kids from 18 schools that are closed, how exactly we're going to have fantastic receiving schools in this same district for 50 closed schools. So I would really like to understand the answer to that. As far as the idea of under-enrollment, the reality is that these same kids whose schools are closed are consistently going to schools that are going to be overwhelmed and are likely to be closed in subsequent round. This is exactly what's been going on in New York City, where there's a huge disproportionate impact on communities of color, and those kids often go to schools that are then closed again because those schools become overwhelmed with a lot of kids who are struggling. But I'd like to kind of get back to the kind of key part of the argument, which is flawed, and that is the idea that the problem is the school and that therefore we need to close the school and closing the school will fix the problem. The problem here is that the schools that are under pressure to be closed, that are so-called underperforming, are schools that are serving a very high proportion of kids living in concentrated poverty and racial isolation. And those kids arrive at school at kindergarten with multiple challenges to learning well and to having their teachers be effective instructors. They are also disproportionately in schools that have fewer resources, that have outdated textbooks, that have less qualified teachers, that have teachers who are less experienced, et cetera. And all of these things compound one another, and it therefore isn't that surprising that the schools don't so-called perform. The problem tends to be not so much the school as all the factors going into the school. Tony Bryke and his colleagues at the Consortium for Research in Chicago documented this in a very extensive, very well thought out piece where they said, you know, we were surprised. We're looking at a city where the vast majority of schools are housing low-income kids. We thought the schools wouldn't be so different from one another. And it turned out that even among majority-minority schools, there is a good large handful of schools, these kids living under extraordinary circumstances, where no matter what you do, unless you infuse some real community resources into these schools and fix these opportunity gaps and make sure that kids are well fed and well housed and they're getting health care and they're getting counseling and all of the things they need to deal with the daily stresses of living in concentrated poverty, you aren't going to change it. So the solution is not closing the schools.
So there was a report that has not gotten much play yet in this country, which was on WBEZ, and the education reporter for the Post as well, Valerie Strauss, did a report saying that in their analysis that saving the money was bogus. That didn't pan out.
Right.
And I thought people are not covering that as much, either in Chicago press or in any other press, and no. Not in the city.
In neither Washington, D.C. nor Chicago did closing the schools really turn out to save money. And I'd also like to say, in terms of whether kids are doing better and they've done better under Daley and really most of the time was Duncan under these reforms, kids in Chicago under these reforms did worse in Chicago than in schools that did not engage in the same reform.
And I would actually disagree with that. That's and again,
you
I would
disagree
that's a,
with the research.
But the fact
I
is mean, that
I would,
they did.
I would
the problem
greatly
with
disagree with that.
With is that the research is very clear about the losses and the gains experienced by students in terms of their achievement levels with this type of reform.
But Mr. Biddle, what part do you disagree with?
Folks, let me just jump in one at a time. Rashawn, what do you disagree with?
Well, I would disagree. Listen, it's a mixed story. We can, you know, on one hand, the percentage, if you look at the National Assessment of Educational Progress and look at the level of students who are actually performed below basic, which essentially are at a certain point functionally illiterate, that has declined by 8 percentage points over the last decade. Meanwhile, you've seen a good uptick in the number of students who are performing at proficient at advanced level. Now, that said, that's all well and good and that's nice, but let's be real, it's not enough. And when you look at the number of students who are going to college and career and are completing college, that isn't happening. And that's a huge issue. But a large portion of that problem is a problem that's not just limited to Chicago. You look at suburban districts throughout the country, they're doing a terrible job both with poor students and with students from middle-class backgrounds. Out here in the Virginia, D.C. area where I spend a lot of time at, you know, we have a situation now where Montgomery County, they've released data that showed that the percent, their high levels of students in who are in elementary and high school who are doing poorly in algebra. This is a problem, and these are middle-class kids, mostly middle-class kids, even in a district that's actually has an increase in the number of students from poverty and impoverished backgrounds. The reality is it's not about the poverty. It's not about poverty. We see schools that do great jobs in helping kids who are working in majority, minority, and high poverty conditions. The problem is that we have a system, we have a model of education using the traditional district that has done that no longer functions to provide high quality education. It hasn't.
Mr.
It was
Biddle,
never designed for that.
All right, well, let me go ahead. Who was that coming in? Was that you, Stacey?
This is Elaine, and I'm sorry. The picture, I'm sorry, is just not mixed. You're mixing up. You know, you're comparing apples to oranges here. Comparing apples to apples, we did a study comparing Chicago, New York City, and D.C. to seven other comparable high-poverty urban districts over the same period of time, and Chicago bombed. Okay, there's no other word for it. Kids in Chicago made fewer gains across the board in fourth grade and eighth grade in math and in reading than kids in other comparable districts that did not engage in these reforms, that did not close schools, that did not have mayoral control, and many of which spent less money. And worse than that, where the gains were made in Chicago, almost all of them accrued not to poor kids.
And let me put this point out here, Elena.
It's just a fact.
You actually wrote about your study, and one of the points I make about that study is that in many cases what you're doing is you actually combine NAEP English reading and math scores, which is
No, in Chicago, I don't combine any NAEP reading and math scores.
Okay, let me jump in. Excuse me, Rashawn, everybody else.
So, Mark, this is actually the issue.
This is Stacey.
This is actually the issue. This is actually the issue. You have someone who's done the research, looked at the numbers, crunched them, and provided an analysis for them. But then the politics come in, right? And the politics is less than friendly to the facts. There is this overreach in terms of urban school reform, and that the model that works is privatization. And when that becomes the politics, all of the facts, all of the research go down the drain. And that's actually the problem that we're dealing with in Chicago. We know there's been study after study, consortium, research think tank, what have you, that they've crunched these numbers, they see the practical application of the policies, and they return an analysis that says that this has not worked. So instead of stopping and understanding what the results of this has been, right, taking out the things that have worked, throwing the things that don't work to the side, and going back to what does work, and we know it works. We know that the highest percentages of African Americans that went to college, it was a result of the large infusion of resources and funding in the 1970s, which went into the 1980s before the Reagan cuts. We know that. We know that we have more college graduates. We know that we have more people completing high school that were in the African that existed in the African American community. We know that from the research, but it's not politically feasible because it isn't privatization.
But here's
that's
the question
we're dealing with.
But here's the question I have. I mean, schools around, and we'll talk about this in the next segment, but schools around the country, are school systems are closing schools right and left. That it's not just Baltimore, it's not just Chicago, it's in Philadelphia, it's in L.A., it's in New York City, it's everywhere. It's been in New York City, it started happening even before it happened in Chicago. People are talking about consolidation is important. There are just not enough students in urban systems because you got to consolidate the schools. You can't afford to keep schools open because of just the sheer cost of keeping them open and the maintenance of schools. So what is the alternative then, Diane? Is an alternative, or is that just a fact that we're stuck with? But it's not just Chicago; it's everywhere.
I'm afraid that you're right. I'm not sure that there is an alternative, and I think that lots of different folks have made really good points, and I think we could really argue about whether Chicago is better off than it was 10 years ago because of some of these policies. I think in some ways it is, and in some ways it's not. But one of the things that my research has brought to this the table here is, to the extent that school closures are a fact, we really want to figure out what happens to the children? How do we make sure that the children are not harmed in the long term and better yet, we would like them to be helped in the long term. Someone earlier made the point that the consortium on Chicago School Research has found that if we reassign kids to substantially better schools, they do better. But, of course, that's not the situation that we're facing right now. So we know that most kids are going to go to schools that are not much better. Although I would say that as a community, Chicago has not really talked that much about the students involved here. And so I think now that the board has decided to close 50 schools, we really need to shift the focus to trying to figure out how do we make sure that the kids get to school safely and how do we make sure that they don't miss a beat in terms of their education.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Finish what you're saying.
No, go ahead. You can go.
So I'm just curious if very quickly, Stacey and Elaine, if you think maybe there's a huge piece of this conversation that's missing the boat, which is what do we do? What about the students? What creates? Nobody's been able to figure out what creates an urban school system, let alone a public school system anywhere that really is working for our kids in the 21st century.
I think that first you have to respect the agency of the parents and the families who are invested in this. We speak about children in Chicago as if they exist on an island unto itself, that they do not come from families and cultural traditions that, you know, respect education and want to be a part of the process. You have mayoral control in Chicago, and mayoral control does not truly allow for the parent voice. Local school councils, which is the only elected representative body within the school district, they've been dismantled effectively, especially in communities that are under-resourced and that are struggling, because if they go on probation, then the local school council becomes advisory. There is a swell from the north side to the west side to the south side in Chicago for an elected school board that represents the communities and the parent voice in this process. You have at least 30,000 parents attend public hearing after public hearing and speak to the specificities, the specific needs and desires in their neighborhood schools. Parents want a neighborhood school that they can walk to, that's safe, that provides a quality education for their children. They don't want to go to a school where they may or may not get in. They do not want to travel large distances to provide their child or their children with, you know, good education. That's resounding. That's what we heard. That's what we understand. So instead of doing that exactly, what we've done is make it harder for parents to have agency, to participate in the process. I'm a parent as well, and I'm one of those black middle-class parents that Mr. Biddle referenced. And my nearest school is a receiving school that will be overcrowded, quite frankly. And I'm not confident that at this point the Board of Education will properly resource and fund this building that has been under-resourced and underfunded for a generation.
But the question... I'm sorry.
Well, you wanted to ask about other models. And really, there are serious alternatives to this that other cities are taking. We're also having this conversation as a school closure, which is a very recent phenomenon. I mean, schools have been going up and down in population for decades, and we haven't seen this kind of massive school closure with exceptions of really rural areas that have consistently lost population over decades. So we should also be careful of assuming or asserting that this is some kind of done deal. This is a new, frankly, experimental, you know, very popular, you know, kind of faddy thing right now. It doesn't mean that it's the right thing. It's certainly not the only thing. Now, I want to talk about two other urban school districts that have faced, granted smaller, almost all school districts are smaller than Chicago, but that have faced very similar circumstances, huge problems with student underachievement, concentrated poverty, concentrated racial isolation, losing students.
Elaine, I have to interrupt. Just hold that thought. We're going to come back. Could you finish that thought? We take a brief break and come back. And another question before we introduce our Baltimore guest to this conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We continue our conversation at this part of our program with our friends from Chicago, and then we invite our friends from Baltimore in to continue a conversation. As I said, we're going to try to do this next week again. Maybe some of the folks from Chicago, bring the folks from Philadelphia in who are dealing with this as well. and really kind of structure this intercity discussion on the future of our schools, which I think is so critical. Because all of us in this business, my business, I've interviewed so many school CEOs and superintendents over the years in Baltimore, New York, Chicago, Washington, and we don't have the answers. We need to find the answers for our children, especially in our urban communities, be they majority African-American, whatever, Latino-American, white American, whatever that is. We're not answering the question. And we have with us here right now Diane Schatzenbach, who is faculty fellow at the Institute for Policy Research, associate professor of human development and social policy at Northwestern University in Chicago. Stacey Davis-Gates, legislative director for Chicago Teachers Union. Rashawn Biddle, editor and publisher of Dropout Nation and columnist for the American Spectator. And Elaine Weiss, national coordinator of Broader, Bolder Approach to Education campaign at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Elaine, you were in the middle of a thought. Finish it up.
Well, I just want to... You know, you had asked about what are alternatives, and there are real alternatives out there, and I want to talk about two cities that have taken a really different, I would say completely opposite path, and they're also very different from each other, Cincinnati, Ohio, and Syracuse, New York. So as I said, these are both school districts that have experienced much of what Chicago's experiencing. Cincinnati 10, 12 years ago was tied with Cleveland, if not above Cleveland, for the poorest school district and city in Ohio, and one of the poorest in the entire country, was hemorrhaging students at a rate higher than what Chicago is experiencing, and didn't really, you know, had the same dilemma, and kind of got together as a city and said, what are we going to do about this? And they said, you know, let's look at what's really affecting the kids in our schools. Our kids are coming to school hungry. Our kids are coming to school from very troubled, dangerous neighborhoods. Our kids are coming to school from families that are stressed, often with single mothers who are working two jobs or not working at all. Again, this is going to sound an awful lot like Chicago. We need to address those things because those kids walk into our schools every day with those problems. They walk into our classrooms, and because so many of them walk in, our teachers are dealing with concentrations of them at levels that make it hard to teach, that make it hard for those kids to learn effectively. And more than that, we're also having a lot of trouble engaging parents. We've got a lot of parents here who didn't themselves have good experiences with school systems when they were growing up. They may not trust our schools. Our schools aren't very good. They're not very happy with the schools. We need to address that problem as well. We need to really engage the parents and the whole community. And so they embarked on a decade-long project to turn every school in the entire Cincinnati school district into a full-service community school. And what that means is the school, first of all, opens long before 9 a.m. It opens at 7, and it's open for breakfast for all the kids. They said, let's make sure every kid starts the day with a good breakfast. That will really help us out in terms of focus, attention, test-taking, learning, whatever. You talk about it. Let's make sure schools are open after school, because these kids have nowhere safe to go. They have nowhere enriching to go. And to the extent that very many of the kids are poor, they don't have good options for after-school activities. They have nothing to build on what they learn during the school day. They don't get music lessons. They don't get drama. They don't get science. They don't even have organized sports. Let's bring those things into the school. Let's partner with the Boys and Girls Club. Bring them in. Let's partner with YMCA. Bring them in. Let's make transportation not such a big issue. And let's keep the school open in the evening so it's a place that parents can come and get engaged with the school. We've got lots of parents who don't speak English. Let's have English language lessons for them. We have parents who haven't graduated high school. Let's have GED classes for them. We have parents who don't know how to fill out a tax form. Let's bring in a pro bono lawyer to help them do that.
Okay.
And that's what they did.
So, and I think community schools is something we need to talk about. It'll be part of a conversation maybe the next half an hour, as well as next week, with some folks who have been doing it around the country and are trying to do it in Baltimore, which is very backwards when it comes to community schools. They've been trying for a long time, but they're not even close, even though we think we are. But we'll come to all that. Let me go to Rashawn and Stacey very fast while we bring in our folks from Baltimore. Rashawn, when I hear what you were saying and what I'm listening to Elaine saying, is part of the problem that folks like to kind of get their ideological backs up without really wanting to address the situation of what we have to do to reform our schools. I mean, we can throw statistics out all over the place, but most stats show that the majority of children in urban settings are not learning what they should. They're not being let it be taught creatively. They're not prepared to deal with society when they get out of here. That's reality. That's what we should be talking about, not whether algebra scores were up by 0.2 points and reading scores were up 0.3 points, unless kids can really do the work, who cares what the stats say, Rashawn?
Well, yeah, and of course, at the end of the day, politics is, you know, at the end of the day, we should focus on the kids and the families and at the end of the day, do that. But we also have to realize that there are the politics of it. You look in Chicago, for example, one of the, you know, if you're the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, there's a reason why you don't want school closed. It means that you're talking about teachers who are not going to have jobs, and they live off of the earnings of teachers. And that's nothing wrong. You know, hey, that's what it is. Those teachers have chosen to do that. But let's be real about the fact that there are, when we talk about the issues, we have to keep in mind that there are politics, and there will always be a certain amount of politics because public education in this country is political.
But you can't have schools without teachers, Rashawn. Are you suggesting we just forget the teachers and lay them off?
Oh, no. What I say is ultimately you don't write off the teachers. What you say, in fact, well, I would argue that in many cases, especially with a good number of younger teachers, they don't feel that their voices are heard. We go to New York City, for example, where they originally had a school board, a teachers union election, and very few of the teachers who are in the rank and file, especially younger teachers, actually voted. In fact, the majority were retirees. And what we need is a voice of teachers.
Okay, let me just time. What were you trying to say just then, Stacey?
In Chicago, that's actually so completely different, right? So in Chicago, what you have is exactly that youth movement within the ranks of this union, whereas you have a strong number of young teachers who do recognize the faulty nature of this education reform narrative. And these are the people who are leading the movement here in Chicago, who are partnering with parents and communities and amplifying the discontent with this policy, with mayoral control, with an appointed school board. In fact, our retirees don't vote for union leadership in Chicago. So, to the extent that application in Chicago is completely different, it's the norm here. So what I would say is that Chicago Teachers Union is actually on the forefront of what unionism is going to look like very, very soon nationally, I think. And I think that that's something that we can all look forward to. In fact, what we want to do is remove mayoral control from the schools, because we do know probably better than most that this has become overwhelmingly political in a place where politics have no room.
Well, Stacey,
let's be real. In fact, there's always been, you know, in general, in education, there's always politics. In fact, the teachers, you know, NEA, AFT affiliates are usually the biggest spenders in teachers' union in school board elections. So that's all. I mean, that's all well and good, but there's
as long as you have mayoral control in Chicago, it's always going to be political. As long as parents and communities do not have agency or recourse in the policies that impact their children.
Just one second. Stacey and Rashawn both for a second. One of the problems, it seems to me, though, is, and before we go to break here, is that I think that whether you have an elected school board or an appointed school board, all the studies and everything shows it doesn't make any difference. It does not help the school. Let me finish. It does not help the schools at all. Prince George's County schools are elected in Maryland. Their school system is a mess with an elected school board. City schools here in Baltimore have a lot of issues. It's an appointed board by the governor. And just like charter schools are no better than regular schools, neither one work. That's what I'm saying. Are we really talking about what it takes to transform schools when we argue about elected school boards or charter schools, neither of which have shown that they approve or don't approve school systems around the country?
Mark, I think you bring up an interesting point. I do. I think you bring up an interesting point. But the majority of schools, the majority of school districts in America have elected bodies. And it's only in large urban areas concentrated with people of color where we debate the efficacy of elected boards and appointed boards. And I think that we actually have to begin to unpack what that means about the agency that black parents, or poor parents, or brown parents have in the policies that impact their children.
Well, I think
folks, as I said, we have to take a brief break here.
This is Elaine. Can I finish up? I think Stacey brings up even, first of all, Mark, what you said is absolutely true. The debates we're having are all about things that don't make any difference. Elected versus appointed school boards don't make any difference for kids. Charter schools, on balance, don't make a difference for kids. We're debating marginal issues here
that
aren't a big issue.
It is actually true, though.
But actually, if you actually look at the recent studies from Credo, and you look at the recent studies of Credo in New York, you look at in Indiana, they in large part they do a better job than traditional districts. Now,
okay, hold on, wait, Sean, we have to say something. Those are balanced by more schools that do worse. Okay, you're only selecting out, again, this is unfair. The overall Credo study shows that twice as many charters do a worse job than as many do well. Okay, yes, New York's do better, Indiana's do better, Pennsylvania's and Ohio's all do worse. Okay, I'm talking about average. I'm talking about all the data here. If you're going to discuss data, please don't cherry pick.
We're all talking about things that are on the market.
Okay, folks, we have to hear, though. We have to kind of move on our segment. And I want to thank our guests for being here who are going to stay with us, and those who are going to stay with us and those who have to go. But we're going to take a brief break, come back, bring in our Baltimore activists to continue the conversation at the point we left off. So don't go away. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. Good to have you here with us. We are going to continue our conversation. I want to introduce guests here in Baltimore City. We're talking from Baltimore City perspectives as well. Davon Love, Director of Research and Policy at Leaders for Beautiful Struggle, who's also a Baltimore City school teacher. And Carol Reckling, who has been a guest on the show many times in the past. It's been a while. It's good to have you back.
Thank you.
Executive Director of Child First, which operates after-school programs in schools that are slated to be rebuilt and some that will be closed, and one of Baltimore's Education Coalition's founding coalition members. Good to have you here, Stacey. Carol.
Thank you, Mark. Good
and
to be here.
And Stacey Davis-Gates is still with us, Legislative Director of Chicago Teachers Union, as well as Elaine Weiss, who is National Coordinator of the broader Boulder Approach to Education campaign at Economic Policy Institute. And folks, you can join us here, by the way. We are live, 410-319-8888. Want to hear your thoughts? Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can also log on to our Facebook page, which I'm about to check, and tweet us at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888. Think about our schools. All over the listening audience from Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, D.C., wherever you're listening to us from, 410-319-8888. So let me back in. I just let me turn to our Baltimore guests for a moment. Davon, you heard the dialogue and conversation.
Absolutely.
As both an activist and a school teacher, your thoughts?
Well, I think a part of the problem that we have is that there is a political and ideological terrain that puts certain options on the table as to how do we fix schools. So do we close schools? Do we have more charter schools? You know, is privatization good? Is it bad? And I think a part of the problem is that many of those issues, I think, are symptomatic of what the core issues are in terms of improving the quality of education in schools. And I think what that is, and I think some people have talked about it, which is the idea of substantive community control and being in the driver's seat of building the institution to meet the needs of the community. And I think a part of the problem is that, you know, we have many so-called education experts and bureaucrats, you know, making decisions about the education of students, and we have to see education as a part of a bigger project for empowering the community and the students to understand their agency and their role, for parents to understand their agency and their role. And I think a lot of what we have is that we have people in the community who are working formally and informally with schools, and a lot of times those voices don't get elevated to the place where they can actually have a substantive input in the discourse. And so I think what's most important, and even if we look specifically at school closings, I think it's important to recognize the notion of these schools as assets to the community. And so if we look at them as assets to the community, the question we have to ask ourselves is that in what way do the folks who are making decisions about what schools get closed are having substantive input from the community as to how those assets can benefit them and the students and the parents and families. And I think until we start to have that conversation, then we're going to continue to be selecting from kind of an already prescribed set of solutions that we all know aren't silver bullets and aren't solutions in and of themselves.
Carol?
I tend to look at what's happening in Baltimore from the standpoint of opportunity. And I have not felt that way for many years, but I certainly feel that way now. And I have to say that for years, Child First, I know, has been working to improve conditions in the school facilities that we partner with, at schools that we partner with. So we've raised substantial funds to to do things to improve safety in schools because we knew that was important for youth.
Mm-hmm.
We've built 10 new playgrounds. And this is coming from the community saying these are the things that we need and we want to see done. We organized the community at our partner schools to get an investment of $3 million in school improvements in buildings that we were working with. The problem was that a lot of these things were Band-Aids, or not just Band-Aids, but it still didn't address the issue of what is a good facility. And when I use the word facility, I always think about the word facilitate, in that a building facilitates learning. And some of the schools in Baltimore City, because we have the largest, oldest stock of buildings in the state, are disgraceful. We have interviewed children who, one little child said, "I hold it all day because I don't want to use the bathroom here." Now, that's ridiculous. Children say, "I'd like to be able to drink water," and we have not been able to use water fountains in the city. These are basic things. Then get to the issues of, what do we know about what facilitates learning today? What do we know about what our youth need today to be prepared to be contributing members of this our society? And can we accomplish that in these 100-year-old buildings or 60-year-old buildings or whatever that we have today? And we come to the conclusion that, no, you can't even wire these buildings. They're so old. So what do you need to do? And I think one of the benefits of what's happened in Baltimore is that there's a proactive move and not just a reaction to a financial crisis. Not to mention the fact that the Baltimore Education Coalition worked tirelessly to get the state legislature to pass a bill and giving $1.1 billion for the community now, working with the school district and others to build schools in our communities that will bring jobs, that will be facilities for learning, and have programs, including community schools, that will be attractive and responsive to the community.
So let me, folks, 410-319-8888. We'll come to these calls coming in. I'll check Facebook here in a minute. The reason I wanted to do this dialogue between Baltimore and Chicago, we couldn't leave all the guests on from Chicago because there's just be too many people for the time. But I'm interested to have Rashawn. Next time we'll keep him on. But Stacey and Elaine, you're still both with us.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a disconnect in America often because people are dealing with stuff like this in Chicago. They're dealing with this in Philadelphia. They're dealing with this in Baltimore, D.C., L.A., across America. And I think what they don't get often, Elaine, is there is a connection between all of us around this and that we see ourselves isolated in these conversations about our schools because they are local and don't have a sense of what it means if people were, I think, connected to transform our schools for our kids and what that really means. So I really don't think we know what it means. Maybe we do know what it means, but if we do, we don't know how to get there. Elaine?
I mean, I'm hoping that what I bring to this conversation is some lessons learned from cities that have already done this. And what I'm not trying to say is that there's never a reason to close a school, or that a school's never under-enrolled, or that there aren't better places for children to learn, or that there aren't schools that simply can't be wired, as Carol said. What I am trying to say is that there has been a very ideological tilt to conversations about school closures, and that the ideology around that has, I think, prevented any discussion of what is and actually is not going to happen with students when their schools are closed. So there are assertions in Chicago and Washington, D.C. that students will go to better schools. And there's a track record showing that they absolutely will not go to better schools. There are assertions in Chicago and Washington, D.C. that closing the schools will save the district money. There's a track record in both of those cities showing that closing schools has not at all saved districts money. Now, this is not to say that kids can't go to better schools, and this is not to say that schools and districts cannot save money or build better schools. I just think it's very important to look at track records and to understand what kids need. And I want to go back to what I think both of the other guests are really talking about and digging into, and that is that understanding the needs of students and communities, which there hasn't been a good track record of doing in either Chicago or Washington with respect not only to school closures but what should be offered to students. There hasn't been a sense that any money that's saved is invested in those students. There hasn't been a sense that a community schools model or enrichment for students is an appropriate response to the needs that students have when they come to school. So I just want to make sure that all these conversations, you know, I hear Rashawn, for example, saying this is not about students in poverty. I'm very sorry. The data is very, very, very clear that it is. That students who are hungry don't learn well, that students who have very disrupted, chaotic lives in their communities and homes are stressed and well, don't focus
can
well.
I,
so,
can I just
school.
Say, I'm well, missing Mark. A meeting this morning where we were, and the purpose of the meeting this morning is to talk about how are we going to engage the community in planning for either a new school or a school that's closing. The Baltimore Education Coalition
Which
members.
Which is a totally different animal from what's been going on in Chicago.
And that's what I'm saying. So for the first time, I'm looking at what's happening here as opportunity. So it's what we're clear about is that it's not about the building. It's about the education that happens in that building, what's going on. So we need, it's not just... It's the community voice is what we're helping to organize and what we will be working on in the next 10, 20 years. There's also a voice that's needed. We've got some educators that are talking about what education can look like, what program needs to go in this school. So the community school is
Mark,
a big piece.
Let me jump in right now. Stacey?
Mark.
Stacey,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, see, here's the dilemma, right, is that you hear Elaine, and Elaine speaks very cogently about the research, the best practices, and the lessons learned, which are indisputable, quite frankly. And then we listen to our brother and our sister in Baltimore speak about the agency of community and parent, the voice, and the respect of that, and then the implementation and the application of that. See, that is the aspiration of all of where we are. But see, we have this thing in America, this policy, this agenda that is being said nationally, because Arne Duncan did leave Chicago where he was the CEO of schools, mm-hmm. and he has transferred the policies that were born in Chicago to the entire nation. So we can't have this discussion without talking about not just about the aspiration of bringing community to the table and wanting their voice respected, but how the aspiration of that is married to the policy and then the implementation of that. And the only way that they're leaving us, particularly in Chicago, is politically. Is that a place where we want to be? Absolutely not.
I think especially the reality
place,
is that you cannot have,
in a place,
it's always going to be political.
In a place, it is. I agree with that. I mean, that's my work. That's my everyday. Yeah. I agree with that. So then how do you then not leave that out the discussion when we're speaking about empowerment and agency within the communities? Right, we have representatives that come from Black and Brown communities who forget their constituency once they're sworn in. Quite frankly, we have very little pushback, and even within our community, we have people who don't think that they're candidates, right? And we miss out on opportunities. So when I hear, I do understand that the elected representative school board in Chicago is not a silver bullet. Absolutely, it isn't. But when you have 30,000 parents with an overwhelming refrain telling you how they want their buildings reformed, telling you how they want their communities resourced, and there's no respect to that, we absolutely have to include that third leg of how we empower these communities politically to hold the representatives they have accountable by, like, kicking them out, and how they also create agendas within these communities that reflect their needs and then get candidates who are indigenous to their communities to carry that agenda.
So, Nico, we have about 2 minutes left before we have to go to break, and Halim is going to be the first caller up. Hold on, Halim. We're going to come to your call as soon as we come back from break. Please don't hang up, but Davon, take us to break.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I think is important is that politics is always going to be involved in whatever process that involves elected officials, that involves, you know, large amounts of money. But I think it's important for us to define what our politics looks like.
Yeah,
what is a politics that is authentic to the community and can be effective at dealing with the machinery of government? And I think one of the things that is crucially important is that we understand the terrain that we're operating in. And I think a big part of that, I would say, it's the notion of institutional racism, right, and the vestiges of slavery and white supremacy that exists in our society. And the way – and say I think what's the practical application of that idea in this context is the way that if you look at many of the school districts that are the most disempowered, right, we see that they're black and brown folks, right, who aren't seen as being able to determine their own destiny. They're not seen as people who are capable of constructing an agenda for what their community should look like and what education should look like in their communities. And so I think it's important for us to, in that context, understand the importance of empowering people who society has, you know, represented as not being capable of being able to construct a vision of education, to authentically empower them, not just give them a template of education that folks have studied in the ivory tower and bring it down to folks and say, here's a template for education, how it should look, but genuinely having folks on their own be able to determine and author their own vision of what education looks like and implement that.
So we have to take a break, but I'm going to come back. We have about 10, 15 minutes left before we get to our next segment, and we're going to go right to Halim, our caller. I apologize to the other callers. It's been such intense conversations, and we haven't had to get to the phones. But I want to explore, where does this money come from to transform the schools? We're not going to. They're saying there's no money. How do we get to community schools? How do we make that transformation take place? We'll come to that conversation and also to what Davon said. Stay with us as we look at the future of our schools, Chicago, Baltimore. Stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We conclude our conversation here on what we do with our schools. We're talking Chicago and Baltimore. We continue this conversation, dialogue across the country and in our own communities here. We have with us from Chicago and D.C., Stacey Davis-Gates, who's legislative director for the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, which many people think is kind of blazing the way for where teachers unions may go in America. We can only hope. Elaine Weiss is with us, who is national coordinator of Broader, Bolder Approach to Education campaign at the Economic Policy Institute. Carol Reckling is in the studio, executive director of Child First, which operates after-school programs in schools that are slated to be rebuilt and some that will be closed. We talked about it a few weeks ago. And one of the Baltimore Education Coalition's founding coalition members. Davon Love is a Baltimore City school teacher in one of our middle schools and director of research and public policy at Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle, and is founded the unique debate camp here at Morgan State University for young people around the country, and which has proven, I think, our debates. Kids have proven, he's no longer a kid, he's now a man. He was a kid when we first met, that have shown what happens when you bring that kind of stuff into schools. Kids can come from the corner to college because they have a focus and learn things. So this is something we need to kind of wrestle with. 410-319-8888. Halima, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you.
Welcome. Go ahead, Halima, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Good morning.
Good. I was calling basically to find out, why do it take the Board of Education so long to get back to those who come in to offer not only their styles, but also the history that follows with them and about them. And it's still going on. Because when you try to hide things from the children, let alone try to ostracize the parents or the women of the city, you know, the mothers of the city, then this is where our children lose out. This is where the family members lose out on the truth about what has happened over the past 11 and a half years. Our children here in America, they're not concerned with trying to structure bombs and things of that nature. Not to put the other people down so much, but at the same time, I discard that because that's nothing that I would do in my life. But when you are accused for something that has happened over the last 11 and a half atrocities in New York and still being challenged by the officers that did, that's not good. education and try to offer yourself again with this same historical legacy that should not be brushed under no earth as and bury them alive, or not to be existing within the society of America, period. How do it take the Board of Education so long to get back to that which has been offered to them? Is it a racist thing? I hope not, because I'm not racist, and I don't feel that I have to wait until Black history, Martin Luther King's birthday, or Malcolm X's birthday to stand forth for who I am.
Halima, I appreciate the call. I'm glad you joined us with your thoughts. I want to kind of ask a question of our guest before time is out, and we have to move on to our next segment. But I want to know what you think has to be done and how we get there, how you pay for it. If part of the reason we have for closing schools is because of money, they're saying it's because of kids who are not performing well, but there are a lot of schools that are not being closed where kids are not performing well as well. So it's not kids not performing well. So what do the four of you think is the path ahead for our urban schools? Baltimore schools are not the different Chicago schools, or schools in Brooklyn, or schools in Oakland. They're just not that different. As much as we like to think we're all unique in our places, we're not. Carolyn, let's just go around the room. I'm really curious to close this with your thoughts on especially when it comes to the money and really doing community schools, which will be a conversation here in the next couple of weeks.
Well, in Baltimore, we've had a couple of stages of school closings and threats of school closing, going back to the early 2000s, where I know Child First fought to keep schools open. Those schools were not closed because there was a lot of organized community voice. And then, again, the facility solution approach, which came about, and here's what's going to happen, and, you know, that was a travesty in my opinion. This time, though, I think there was a movement more to get new schools, new facilities. And the point that the state made was that you can't have new schools unless schools are closed, the buildings are closed that are not fully utilized, which didn't seem, I mean, when you really think about it, it didn't seem like a terrible exchange. But there's a plan, and I think people have had some role in the plan, probably not as much as many people would like. Now the conversation is, okay, we have the opportunity to have a new facility. What is the program for education that will be in that facility? And those conversations are the important ones that will be happening before a new building opens.
So then we only have a few minutes left in the segment. I really want to have a shot here before we have to move on, because we have to move on to our segment about Bradley Manning. But Stacey, a brief thought?
Sure. I mean, in Chicago, we have opportunities for this. We have tax incremental financing that is supposed to help our blighted areas in the city. However, this tax incremental financing has helped the blighted area of downtown and the financial district, which gives a new definition to blighted. Right now, we know that there is over $700 million in TIF surplus throughout the city. If that money is returned to the original taxing districts, we very strongly assume that this would help to plug some programmatic cuts, some possible layoffs, to modernize some of our schools as well. We also know that in Illinois, we're working with a flat tax, very antiquated taxing structure that does not help to pay for education in the state of Illinois, just much less in the city of Chicago. We know that that is necessary, a fair tax system statewide. We also know that the district has participated in toxic interest rate swaps. These swaps can be renegotiated, have been renegotiated in other places. We know that that could render at least $40 million annually. We also know that way in which we prioritize the school budget, it shows the moral and ethical principles of our city leadership. And quite frankly, it's a problem. I agree wholeheartedly with Mr. Love that the agenda for education has to come from the community in which those people who are being educated reside.
We're almost out of time, Stacey.
Sorry.
I just want to have a final thought. I apologize. Davon, a quick thought, and then I want to hear a quick thought from from our last guest.
So, I mean, just two quick things. I think one, there needs to be a strong attempt to organize those in the community to have the political muscle to get the things that we need for our communities for education. I think, you know, an example of that was the billion-dollar legislation that got through that's going to provide more facilities or better facilities in Baltimore City. But I think the other thing that's also important is that, you know, I think a lot of times education becomes an ideological playground for a lot of different kinds of organizations, whether it's, you know, government agencies or professional advocacy organizations, to profiteer from education reform. And so this is why this is why community control and community input is so important and essential, not just for the importance of having the people in the community make their own decisions, but to also protect from the fact that this is an issue that people use for their own political and economic financial gain, and that it's important that whatever reform happens, whatever decisions are made to close schools or privatize schools, that it's made by those in the community in order to protect ourselves from the ways in which a lot of these issues are used for other people's own.
And Elaine Weiss, a very quick thought, because we really are out of time here.
Very quick thought is, without even investing more money, and we should really think about investment if we're talking about kids, we should just be more efficient. So we should move our money within education from remediation, from more special education, from retaining kids, from trying to fix things later on, to the front end. So we should do much more on early childhood. We should do much more front end. And we should do efficiencies. We should bring programs into schools so that they have space to operate there and they don't have to do separate operations. Health clinics can be incredibly cost effective. They could save tons of money in emergency room visits. So if we think about reorganizing our current spending, we could do much more for kids immediately.
Elaine Weiss, thank you so much for taking your time. Is it Weiss or Weiss, by the way?
Weiss.
Weiss, make sure I have that right. I'm sorry, I should way ahead of time. I'm sorry. National Coordinator for the Broader Boulder Approach to Education Campaign at the Economic Policy Institute, Stacey Davis Gates, Legislative Director for the Chicago Teachers Union. Always great to have you with us. Thank you, Stacey, for spending
the time
with us today. And Carol Reckling, Executive Director of Child First. Always good to have you back. Good to have you back
here.
We have more talk to have. And Davon Love, Director of Research and Public Policy at Leaders of Beautiful Struggle. And Baltimore City School Teacher, good to have you here, too.
Pleasure to be here.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we are going to jump into the case of Bradley Manning coming up next week right in our backyard.